So Carl and I met at DevTeach, Jean-René Waugh's show.
Which is coming, making a comeback.
Yes, we're going to be there. I'm super excited about that.
I did not know that.
Oh, no, we had to go. Because we literally, that's where Carl and I met, was at the speaker's dinner at Jean-René's show in 2004.
Wow.
And to hear Carl tell it, he wasn't even saying, I knew who he was.
Right.
Like Carl put up like the first Visual Basic web page in the world. Right. This was Carl and Gary's VB homepage. I went to that page. I always knew who Carl Franklin was. Right. That was this guy. You know, right. he always made this stuff. But I was a speaker. You know, I knew JR. All was well. But you know how speaker dinners are. I'm telling stories and having a good time. And Carl was sitting at a different table. So he's like.
And of course you're loud enough that he heard you.
This is what he always says. Right. It's like, look, when Campbell's telling a story, everybody's going to hear the story.
Hence why we're recording.
And so he came over and we chatted for a bit. And then he said, well, why don't you come be on the show? And so I did a show with him. And it was fun. And we never stopped talking after that. Carl and I are similar in a lot of ways. And we connected right away. And so after a few months of him doing the show with Rory, I got involved and I was doing bits on that show. And then
one thing leads to another. And here we are.
And here we are. So then 100, I came on board as a co-host. Figuring, hey, the previous two guys did 50 shows each. I'll do 50 shows. I'll be done, right? Missed the mark by a little bit.
Just a bit. But you loved it, though.
I do all the content planning, right? I mean, really, that's what I enjoy more than anything else. If you think about all the stuff that I do, it all ties back to this idea of what do we need to think about as a development community 6 months from now, nine months from now, right? And so I'm always gathering that information. And I'm fortunate enough that I can take that info and use it in lots of different ways. I make 200 podcasts a year. I plan four conferences that I own and a half a dozen others that I don't, that I just collaborate with.
This is on top of your day job, too.
Well, this is my day job, really.
All right, fair enough.
You know, I mean, it is content thinking is something I get to do every day. That's become the job. And I sell that service, right? So there's lots of folks that I collaborate with. So, you know, conferences in Europe will call me and we'll help organize their dates and I'll get them a few North American speakers and .NET Rocks will help promote the show and then I'm going to help them with content planning. It's fun to do.
So you know what, though?
Don't mind me. This is nice.
And by don't mind me, you just interrupted our conversation that's being recorded.
So another, a.k.a. mind me.
Yeah, exactly. Specifically mind me. But this is why we do it at shows, because this way it allows... You know, people that interrupt, walk in, ask questions. It's called the Ask the Expert for a reason. What would you like to ask Mr. Richard Campbell?
I feel bad. I interrupted. I
just
wanted a photo.
Sorry. Do you want to print it and he'll autograph it?
You
could just take the photo, too. It's all right.
Yeah.
Pictures are okay.
And this is the beauty.
Right now, I'm so embarrassed.
It's the beauty of post-production.
Yeah. Everything is editable.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay, we're good.
Seaplanes flying across.
Exactly.
This is my home. Exactly. That's why I live here.
Don't do that. That makes me jealous. That makes me jealous.
I live here. I don't do a lot of work here.
Yes, because you travel now, what, 300 days a week?
You know, it's over half, but not by much. But the girls are in college. You know, my wife travels for her work.
Right.
So, yeah.
That's what I always loved about you guys, is that you meet up in the world for vacation.
Yes, we do. That's exactly what we're doing.
Fascinating.
Yeah. In fact, I'm on the Azure tour, the international Azure tour. So we're going to Israel and to France.
My peeps.
And they're coming with. She's coming with. So she's booked a few things around that, work related too. She does some work with some Israeli companies. So
she's really cool.
On the day you're going to be busy, I'll do this.
And that's actually really cool that you guys are actually coordinated to that extent.
Yep.
I almost feel like you need a specific planner to pull that off.
Yeah, it takes a certain amount of energy around that. But, you know, it's been a great partnership. I mean, we're married 20 years, and we have sort of figured that out. There have been times where you literally have passed keys in the airport.
I remember you telling me. Yeah. We were talking about this at Prairie Def Con.
Right. Yeah, and she had... she was coming back from China as I was outbound to, I think, Amsterdam.
Yeah.
And so I parked the car and then met her flight, gave her the keys, told her where I parked it, and then I got on my plane.
Crazy. It's crazy to me. I was telling my wife that story at one point. She's like, don't you even...
It's not happening.
No. She's like, we tried the whole long distance things for 6 weeks and failed miserably.
Well, you know, a really interesting thing about travel is, like, somewhere around the 3-week mark, I just start getting angry, right? Like, I can't, even if I just do a 24-hour turnaround at home.
Right.
Go home, do some laundry, have a meal with my family, pack the bag, leave the next day. That's enough. Just to sort of touch, right? It works both ways. If it's 3 straight weeks in a row, I'm angry. 3 straight weeks at home, yeah. And she starts looking at me like, don't you have somewhere to go? Why are you still here?
That's awesome. That's
so
awesome.
For a long time, when the kids were littler, it was week on, week off.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's always more work than you can do. So I would take a week of consulting somewhere. And so you leave Saturday, arrive right. Sunday, because you're flying east.
In the office Monday through Friday.
Monday through Friday, writing at night. So you just work all the time.
Yep.
Come home Saturday. Sunday, do laundry. Monday to Friday at the school with the kids, right? I'm volunteering for this and going on that field trip. Like, I'm fully engaged at home. Next Saturday, leave again. So I basically worked a 2-week cycle with a 5-day weekend.
Okay. And
that's the way to look at it. And it worked. It worked pretty well.
Crazy. You know,
it got a little weirder as time went on. The show got larger, and there's always more work that you can do.
Right.
It's just, these days I only take consulting gigs by referral. Typically, another consultant calls me and says, "I need your style, right?" And I'm a guy who's really good in the boardroom.
You think?
I've had a lot of practice. Okay?
Practice does make perfect.
So, I mean, that's a very different dynamic of coming at that from I worked with a security person who's a really good penetration tester. So she's doing some work in an office, figuring out the security problems, and realizes there's a problem between senior management and the IT guys and so forth, and says, "Hey, any chance you could come by for a couple of days?" And so I fly out and we meet, and then you start having those conversations, sort of and figure out what's going on there, like, what's the relationship, what's it look like.
Yeah,
that dynamic, being able to talk about technology as an asset to a company, to a CFO type, mm-hmm. or to a COO type, they just come at it from a different perspective. I mean, that's an important skill. Certainly, it's like, you want to accelerate your career, learn to speak the language of the people who are deciding how things are going to happen in the company.
True. Which is actually a great segue to the first question I have for you.
Okay.
Is actually talking about accelerating careers.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So a lot of times, come to events like this, Let's Dev This Vancouver, to learn about various things that are up and coming.
Right.
Now, the one challenge that a lot of time comes up is, how do I actually make the time for this? Or more importantly, how do I justify investing the time?
Right.
So it's kind of like, how do you frame it? Or how should developers frame coming out to a show like this or coming out to any conference as an investment in their career?
Stephen Covey talks about this, the Seven Habits guy. The seventh habit is sharpening the saw.
Right.
Right? And he starts it with the whole analogy of a guy cutting down a tree with a big saw, exhausted, working super hard. And somebody says, "Hey, why don't you, take a break and sharpen the saw?" He says, "I'm too busy. Can't you see? I'm cutting down the tree."
Right.
And the silly part, of course, is if you sharpen the saw, the tree goes down that much faster.
Yep.
Right? So careers are very much the same thing. You can't always be spending your time learning new things. You have to go do the work once in a while. But the other way is also a problem, too. A lot of developers, and technology people in general, they don't like being a cog. Often, we're in an industry where most people don't understand what we do. It's certainly not in detail. And so the non-technical people, typically in management, will try and categorize you. They'll make you a cog. Hey, you're a front-end dev.
Yep.
Hey, you're a database guy, right? They make you in that cog. They want to keep you in that cog spot so you'll be happy. And you're not happy with that.
But I'm going to pause you for a second, though, because a lot of times developers tend to do that to themselves also.
Without a doubt, because it's simpler. You're trying to explain to somebody who doesn't know what you do, how to understand you. So you'll wear the label happily.
Yep.
Right? And that's the trap you fall into, is you get trapped in this cogness sort of relationship. And the fact that you want to break out of that sort of confusing to folks, right? I think it's an important part of being effective in our careers to say, there's a path for me. There is a place I want to go. The biggest thing that a day like this or a week like this at a conference is it's those times to think about leading your career as opposed to managing your career.
Right.
Right?
Or following someone else's plans for your career.
Exactly. Well, this is the thing, is your career is always going to go somewhere. The question is, are you choosing where it's going to go?
Right.
And so you can't spend all your time looking at the horizon trying to figure out where to go. But you have to do it once in a while. Maybe it's 1 week a year. But it has to be not none.
Right.
And so This is a leadership moment. This day is a leadership time
personal
for your career.
Leadership,
100% personal. Right. This is for you. I think it's one of the biggest assets to an in-person event. I get away from the office. Yep. I get some insight into what's going on in the industry around me, and I get a moment to reflect and say, "Am I going where I wanted to go? Am I doing what I wanted to do?"
Yep.
And then maybe start talking about that management piece of how would we change things.
And that's actually an interesting point, too, in that a lot of times people will stick to what they know and then we'll just learn more of
yes.
that. And one of the things that we try to do here is bring a whole bunch of different topics all under one roof so that people can pick and choose. But it's to me, it's actually when I say that, people look at me like, but why would I just not want to know more of what I do?
Right.
And I'm like, well, no, why don't you just diversify your portfolio? Because ultimately, a developer is a developer. Like, you're going to tackle all these different technologies together at some point.
And there's a synergy to that array, too. You know, the best developers I've seen know multiple languages, not because it's fun, and not because they learned them serially.
Well, but let's be honest.
They are kind of fun.
Yeah, let's be honest. I mean, we are all geeks, and they are kind of fun. And the more you know, the more, you know, you can speak different languages.
But there's a side effect to learning F-sharp well. When you start thinking functionally, it changes the way you write C-sharp.
For sure.
Right? And that's not a bad thing. The whole Euler projects, E-U-L-E-R, so these are a bunch of simple exercises. They get progressively harder.
Yep.
So the way to really get value from Euler is not to use the language you're comfortable with. Or maybe do the first, take a given Euler exercise, do the first one in C-sharp the way you're used to. Then try it in a different language. Right? Or if you want to really have some fun, take stuff away. Do it with no if statements. Think about that.
Yeah, that one, specifically if statements.
Absolutely.
Challenging.
This is something we did. We talked about this with Mark Seaman on .NET Rocks a number of episodes ago. If you start constraining your language so that it forces you to think more deeply about the way that code actually executes, that changes your mind.
Yeah.
You start thinking differently about those things. You can write better code. The more ways you can look at a given problem and solve it, the more effective you are at solving that problem. And so all of those exercises, those different techniques, they're about thinking more deeply about how you actually execute on these things. And it's not something you can do day to day, again, but it's a good occasional exercise. Recently recorded a show, I don't even think, at the point we're recording this, we haven't even published it yet. We were talking about learning new shortcuts in Studio 2015.
Because, keyboard shortcuts.
Well, I can't tell you how many people I watch using 2015 like it was 2010.
Yeah.
Just a faster version of 2010.
It boggles my mind.
There's so many great features in it. And again, you can't be learning new things in Studio 15 every day. A, it won't stick, and B, you'll never get anything done. But if you never take the time to actually, you're never going to get better.
Well, and there's new versions of things for a reason.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just, we'll call it marketing that says,
we're not just adding stuff to add stuff.
It's not just marketing that says, hey, you're going to be more productive with these tools. Like, actually, so Susan Ibach has a whole series on Channel 9 on specifically Visual Studio. It was 2013, now it's 2015 shortcuts. And it's actually some of the most viewed videos that we have on Channel 9 because they're literally in 30 seconds, boggles your mind to say, like, a single shortcut can save you minutes at a time or when you add those up.
I was working on a chunk of code, and I was flipping between two tabs using Control-Alt-Arrow back and forth. And somebody's looking on my shoulder going, how are you doing that? Because I have to use the mouse to click between the tabs, and I'm going flip, da-da-da, flip, da-da-da, flip, you know?
The mouse, so you see, to me, as it went back in my development days, admittedly, I haven't done code in a while, partially because I enjoy doing this way more than coding.
Right.
I love code, I do, but this is more fun. Anyway. When I was doing it, though, like the mouse was the one thing that slowed you down all the time.
Take your hand off the keyboard. You know, are you making a mistake? Like, that seems crazy. You know, that is the beginner tool, right? The art of modern software is this: the beginner can discover their way around it. The expert knows where things are and goes there the least amount of time. You're talking about Studio. Like, this should be the tool you're the most expert in. You should never need to touch the mouse. You should. But this gets back to this element of us honing our craft, right? Of actually being good with the tools that we need to use, but also thinking seriously about where we want to go, how we grow as a developer, how we actually get better long term.
And I love how you called it a craft, because that's the one thing that I find, like, a lot of developers get stuck in this idea that it's actually a job.
Right.
And they'll only leave it as, it's a job. This is what I do. This is what I get paid for. Fine. But the truth is, it is a craft. Like,
yes.
Not only are you creating art, I happen to think code is art, but like, it's an actual skill that you can use for a whole bunch of different things.
Well, and it's a mastery skill.
Right.
No song is ever perfectly played. No piece of code is ever perfectly crafted, right? There's always a level of improvement. There's always something more you could do. There are diminishing returns, right? And I think it was Joyce who said, no art is ever finished, only abandoned, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, at some point, you have to stop.
Right.
But it doesn't mean there isn't more you could have done. And so, you know, part of owning your craft is recognizing this sort of sense of mastery, that there's always things I could do to get a little bit better. It's just a question of what is sufficient return for what my customer ultimately is paying for.
Right. Now, but let's take that one step further. So let's take it outside of the concept of the customer or mm-hmm. the thing that is paying the bills. Because
yeah.
you can use code, and I mean, you'll talk about this a bit later, I'm sure,
yeah.
but you've done several things where, you know, you're taking your knowledge of code and stuff like that for something that doesn't pay you for anything.
Well, and you see that all the time. What is open source but a group of people who'd rather write code,
right?
That are literally just trying to make the world a better place, right? By improving its tools and so forth, right? Why does Wikipedia exist? Like, these are all people's choice to contribute their time to hone something. Now, I'm firmly in the camp of software is engineering, but I also agree that calling ourselves software engineers besmirches engineering. Right, we haven't earned that title yet. We don't have the set of disciplines around it. We
right.
don't have that governing body
yep.
the way that true engineers have, that is ultimately that we are beholden to an industry beyond beholden to our customer.
Right.
Right. The customer may want to spend less money on the concrete on the bridge, but that professional engineer says, no, I'm not putting my name to this unless we follow these engineering requirements, says this is the concrete we use.
Yep.
We're not there yet at software.
And would we ever want to be? I don't think so.
I think we need to be.
Ah, okay.
In the sense that software is no longer an option, right? We are eating the world. Mark Andreessen is not wrong, right? Software is consuming everything, and so software is impacting the real engineers.
Right.
Right? They're building stuff right. They're building the airplane right. The software's not built to the same quality.
True.
Right? And they're trying very hard. When you talk about aircraft, pretty serious business to build the software right. But
I've seen one too many Maydays where on Discovery where the issue was software.
Yeah, or the interface to the operators. Like, there's an interesting set of problems there. We're head hurling towards the automated driving vehicle.
Yep.
It's inevitable. You can see it on the horizon. And interestingly enough, it is developers. It's us that are going, uh-oh. Like, that's, yes, if we get that software right, we will save lives and things will be better. Getting that software right is not a small thing.
And it's always the saying as you always hear is that the software is only as good as the developer who built it.
Yeah. Well, you would hope that the process compensates for the mortality. Right?
Fair.
I mean, that's the idea of engineering, is that we're not beholden to the excellence of any one person, but beholden to a process that guarantees that people can make mistakes, but they will be caught. Right? That's what a mature engineering practice looks like.
Testing
well,
again.
Well, exactly. And we're starting to get there. You look at modern automated testing and software, you're starting to see the signs of engineering discipline that look more like civil engineering and materials engineering and things like that. That is a routine thing for you to be able to properly test a component. You know, each time they build another chunk of the SkyTrain, another one of those modules, it's tested, right? There's a standard set of procedures to be able to test that. Can we get to that point with software? I mean, I see the pieces, I see the tools, we're just working on the discipline.
Right, and it's an evolution. I mean, well, 10 years ago, automated testing or software testing in general was nowhere near what it is today.
Absolutely. And it is a very young industry. We've been building bridges a lot longer than we've been building software.
Relatively.
And in Canada, there's this apocryphal story, the Iron Ring event, they call it, right? Where a bridge collapsed. I believe it's in Ottawa. And again, I don't know that it's actually true, if it's just an apocryphal story. And that the engineers took metal from the bridge and fashioned rings from it as sort of a symbol of, you know, we never let this happen again.
Right.
Right. We don't allow ourselves to make the mistakes that would cause something like that to collapse. I always wonder if we're going to have an Iron Ring event in software. One of these days.
Interesting.
I thought Y2K was going to be it.
I was sure that Y2K was going to be
Y2K paid for my house. I made a lot of money fixing a lot of software in the 18 months run up to Y2K.
Makes sense.
It was big business.
Makes sense.
And we pulled it off. But I'll tell you, I was skeptical. That was a lot of software to fix. And if we had If it had gone the way it could have gone, and we basically ground the planet to a halt, we would have been legislated, right? That would have changed the industry alternately. I would hope.
It may have, but it may have changed the industry anyway, just not in that formal and official way.
Yes, and not through legislation, which is kind of terrifying. Like, do we want to be legislated? Probably not.
Nah, then things get complicated.
But if you talk about from a civil society perspective, should we be legislated? Probably. Right? Lives do depend on our software. I would hope we as an industry get to a place where we can adopt legislation without hesitation. No, our software is good enough. These are the procedures that are put in place.
Yeah.
You know, we're fine. We're not there yet, but I think we're going to need to be. Like, the time is getting short. Software is permeating everything, and our level of professionalism has to grow to that. That being said, there's only one PE, right, professional engineer, on a given bridge project.
Yeah.
Right? There's only one person in the end who has to sign off on that. It doesn't mean that everybody has to rise to that standard, but that we have to be able to measure the skills of people. We have to be able to qualify the work that they do. And that there is a hierarchy of role within any given project.
So, you know what? Side note on that one, since you're talking about, you know, the certification, let's call it certification.
Sure.
What's your take on certification for developers? Because that camp goes either way. You know, it's like you have the camp that says it's an art, and therefore you don't need certification. There's the camp that says, no, there's a defined set of ways that this needs to happen, and so therefore you should be certified and therefore have a certification.
Certification doesn't mean anything if there's no blood in the game, right? Our biggest problem with certification right now is that there's no consequence to you disobeying the certification. Like, if you talk about the bridge scenario, okay, with a professional engineer, there is an engineering board that certified that person. And the most important thing about that engineering board is they're on the line too.
Yeah.
When that bridge fails for whatever reason, the board's as much beholden as the engineer is, right? You talk about malpractice suits in law, right? The big thing about those bodies is that they're beholden to their professionals. That's what we're missing in software, is someone willing to take on the risk. I bet on this guy with my money. Right? If that person fails, if you follow their procedures and they signed off on it and they fail, I pay. Almost think of it from an insurance perspective. Could we get an insurance policy on a software development project?
That would definitely be interesting.
On time, on budget, to standard.
Yeah.
Let's think about
it.
Never happens. Not right now.
Right.
But maybe a certain class of project. Software for aircraft. Why wouldn't you want it to be authenticated to that level?
Sure.
Right? Software for operating all of the utilities. At some point, the internet's going to be recognized for the utility it actually is, and it will have to be operated to the same rigorous standards that we expect our water to be operated at, our electricity to be operated at. Not that we always are compliant.
Well, but we have that in terms of data centers. We have that in terms of, we just don't have that in terms of software.
We're getting there. Right, and data centers aren't that well regulated yet. We don't know for sure, but you see the need, right? That these are part of what makes civil society work, and so have to be held to a specific standard.
Right.
So I see a path there that we may take on certain projects and take them to that standard and start having people qualified at that level. I mean, that's the paradigm shift, right? And again, if I go back to sort of Covey terminology, you have attitudes, behaviors, and paradigms. So an attitude is the craftsmanship movement, right? Yep. That I'm beholden to my craft more than my customer.
Yes.
That I will build software the right way. That's a way of thinking, right? A behavior would be the agile movement. I have a set of behaviors, of processes I use that encourage good attitudes,
yep.
Right? Both those things are compensating effects to try and build better software. A paradigm shift is the, I am legally liable for the consequences of my software. And so suddenly attitude and behavior fall out of that pretty clearly. Right?
Interesting.
Like, that's where you actually would move the whole ball of wax. Is if we, and you don't even think about it with software. What's the first thing you do with every piece of software you ever install? You sign an agreement that says, we're not liable. That's the first thing.
Which, of course, nobody actually reads that.
But if you ever do, A, you're going to fall asleep. It's brutal.
And long.
But if you actually get into it, what it says is, the limit of our liability is the price you paid for the software, not the consequences of it. Right? And so we're obviating the most important. And the crazy part is, when software works, it's insanely valuable. Right? We double, triple, quadruple the productivity of people. Tenfold increases in productivity with good software. Look, if you you're the sales manager for a company. You're the sales, you run the sales team. And you raise sales in the organization by 20%. You've killed it. You've knocked it out. They send you to Bermuda, your employee of the year, da-da-da-da-da-da. We routinely, as software developers, build software that doubles the productivity of a team. And we never go to Bermuda.
Through enablement.
Well, and I think the biggest thing here is we don't take on the ROI in the first place. We don't estimate it. We don't bet on it. We don't justify it. And we don't own it. And we should. So I got really successful at performance tuning because I could do the numbers. And I would come back and say, I need to spend $250,000 to do this performance tuning. I think I'm going to increase the performance of the site by 50% as a consequence, and you're going to earn it out in 6 months. Right? I spoke CFO. Right? I spoke finance manager. And so it's like, here's your money. And everybody's in awe. Like, how did you get that money? It's just because I actually made a commitment to get results with that money. It's going to earn that money back out. We spend $250,000 and we'll make $1 million this year. And then we go. Right?
Okay. But going back to our career evolution and stuff like that, a developer who is, let's call it what it is, sitting there writing code and stuff like that, how do you develop that mentality? Like, how do you go from, you know what, I'm just building something because of software,
right,
to actually having that paradigm shift and they're actually thereby accelerating where you go as a developer to bigger and better things?
I think the first question first thing you need to acknowledge as a developer is you don't make the company money. You help other people make the company money,
right,
at best, right? So the first question I would ask anybody working in an organization is, do you know how the company makes money? Because I'd be surprised how many times people just don't know.
Yep.
It's like, how does this company actually function? Because in the end, all software does is either run the engine faster or measure it more precisely. And if you're not doing one of those two things and know clearly what you're doing, you're not that important to the organization. Again, we've already demonstrated that when software's done well, it makes a huge difference. So understanding what your company actually does, what's important to the business, how it actually functions, and then it's as much a technical aspect of we buy these, make them into this, and sell it here, as the people that are involved in that and what their long-term goals are. And if you understand the goals of the organization, understand the people within it that are helping go there, and you can help build software that moves that way, like they may be only feeding you with an eyedropper of knowledge. Right? And again, I'll fall back on Stephen Covey's mindset. There is the circle of influence, and outside of that, the circle of concern. Our area of concern is always bigger than our area of influence. You should be concerned that an asteroid might destroy the planet. Your ability to influence that's probably smaller. Okay, so that's, we'll put that out there, we're in here. Now let's think about in the workplace. You should be concerned that your company is thriving or not. That sort of depends on whether you're going to be laid off or not. So you may or may not have influence on it. You're not the CEO. You're not the CFO. But at least if you have an awareness of what's going on in that space, and you can start to have an influence, can software make a difference to the profitability of a company? Yeah, of course. It can.
It can also make or break the company.
Without a doubt. And so as I start thinking about how the software is going to help the business be successful, it's still the same feature I'm writing. I'm just thinking about it differently.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting thing happens when you start pressing on the edges of your circle of influence, expanding into that circle of concern. It gets larger. You'll know more, so your concerns will grow, but your influence will grow also. You lean against those edges. You start building that feature, not to the specification, but to the goal of the company.
Well, see, and therein lies the interesting predicament, because you're, as a developer, you're always working to someone else's specifications.
Exactly.
Right? So that, first of all, that's a pretty bold move that you're saying, hey, let's go past the requirements.
I'm going to press against it, right? I'm not saying ignore it. I'm saying press against it.
And you're not saying, and for the record, you're not saying challenge it either.
No, I would even
push it a bit.
Yeah. I would challenge it in the sense that, is this the best requirement we could have? Is this, how does this actually deliver the goal? I have read the company's financial statements. I have looked at the company's vision. How does this vision equate to this feature?
Yeah.
Are we actually working on the right thing? All too often, we're being treated like cogs, and we're acting like cogs. I have fed you the information. Just do it.
Just do it.
The fact that you would turn around and question that a bit, this is the essence of this DevOps movement. The first stage in getting DevOps into your organization, really thinking that way, is actually understanding the whole flow. How did you get these requirements? Why do they exist? How do they influence important goals of the company? You want to know those things because you'll build better software as a consequence. The more deeply you understand the overall flow through your organization, the more effective that flow is, and the more effective you are as an employee of the company.
And that's, I think, that's the important part, is that realizing that, yes, as a developer, you build stuff, but you have a lot more, it's called potential,
right,
to do more with what you're doing. Goes back to how we started this conversation. It's a craft.
Yes.
Right? It's not just, I have a requirement, and I will build. You could treat it as that.
Yes. If you only write to what's on the paper, you'll write the minimum necessary to get to that paper. Right. But what if you could write for what's on that paper with the context of the vision of the company as a whole? You'll write more, right? You'll write better. More importantly, you'll press against things. Look, the only way you make steel is by getting the iron very hot. You have to put pressure on it, right? You get a better product with a little friction. It doesn't have to be mean. It doesn't have to be aggressive. But pressing against something can make it better. Just taking the requirements as rot, not pressing against them and trying to understand them better, not really seeing where your code goes, not watching the testing on it, not seeing how it's used in the field and actually getting feedback for how it's been utilized, you're missing out on writing the best software you could make. The person who takes that on, who really wants to own the feature, knows why it's being built the way it's built, knows why the requirements came down when they came, and sees the outcome, how it lands in the field, how people are actually using it, that's a more valuable, more effective device.
See, no, so here, so what I find is when we take out the context of employment and we take all of what you just said, you want to test that skill, you want to hone that skill. I actually find take yourself out of the workplace and stick yourself into something like Humanitarian Toolbox.
Absolutely.
Right? Or some other cause or some other something that challenges you to think about not requirements, but why you're doing something. That's why I love hackathons, right?
Yep.
Like, In such a short period of time, you're not actually expected to build full-out software. But you're using the 24 hours or 40 hours or whatever it is to think about the why, right? Because you have no choice. You have to be very quick about what you choose to do.
Well, nobody wants to come to a hackathon just for the sake of hack. Something had to inspire you in the first place.
In theory. Or at least I hope so.
You know, I bring Humanitarian Toolbox into those situations because I find the projects we're working on very inspiring. And when I get a chance to share them with other people, they get inspired too.
Right.
And suddenly they know what I want to do in the next 48 hours is not so much I just want to write code. It's like I want to move the needle forward on a project that's going to save lives. Tell me, you know, how can I do that? And they grab onto that understanding of the project. You know, the way I usually, when folks want to get involved with Humanitarian Toolbox, I often say, take a look at these projects. See which one speaks to you. They most of them have a video. They have a story behind them because they all tie back to, here's an effort to save lives. This is a project that helps get smoke detectors into homes that don't have them by coordinating the volunteers efficiently. It's not a wildly complicated project, but it makes a huge difference when it's done well.
You know, it still comes back to the software that runs it.
Every time. When they were organizing the installers by hand, it'd be lucky if they got two installs in a given day. When our software started doing its thing, they got eight installs in a day. We save lives.
And that was all built by volunteer developers.
100% volunteer driven, right?
So, of course, then I asked the question, and surely you've spoken to hundreds, if not thousands, of developers on this particular topic, but why go out and donate your time?
Yeah, and it's an interesting truth, and we had folks, developers that showed up at a hackathon at a conference, a group of friends, and then they used to go out bowling on Wednesday nights, and then now they stayed in, hung together, and took pull and sent in a pull request or two on a project. We like exercising our craft. We like the fact that it's outside of our normal work. We're not always confined in the same rules of our workplace.
So I'm happy that you said that, because what I should have said before was, what do you find is that that driving force to get someone to volunteer their time for something that they could technically get paid to do?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's a really interesting truth. It's an opportunity to do more, right? They want to have an impact, right? They want to leave a dent on the universe in one way or another. Why did they choose our project? It's a story that actually speaks to them. And so the Already project, the one I was talking about, the smoke detector story, although it's applicable to a lot of other things, the current leader for that is James Chambers, who's an MVP in Canada. And he met that project 3 months ago, 4 months ago, and it just spoke to him. know, that was this mattered to him. This was in the back of our heads. We all have an energy to be a better citizen.
Right.
Maybe we don't put it that way. It's like, how do I contribute? And it's a little frustrating to have a great developer who's contributing by, you know, packing boxes. Not that the boxes didn't need to be packed, but it's right. like, hey.
And not that it's any less meaningful.
Without a doubt. But it's like, you know, I have a superpower, right? I know how to write code. And, you know, I'd like to exercise that power one way or the other. And so, you know, James met the Already project, and it became apparent he should lead it. That's how inspired he was. He inspired us back. And now that's where he is. But it's just from the work. You know, what engages you? What matters to you? And I hear over and over again, we made HTBox because I was frustrated with the ability for developers to contribute their skills in a meaningful way to a charity. If you want to make the full commitment, Mark Schrum is here. He had a school that mattered a lot to him that he wrote software for in his own time. He committed the hundreds of hours it takes to write a decent piece of software to own the whole problem.
Yep.
Anybody can do that as a developer. You know you can. You just recognize the scope of the commitment, which is why you do it carefully. Because software is not really free, right? No. Software is free like a puppy's free.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the point behind HTBox was, I want you, as a developer, only able to commit a weekend. You know, a 48-hour sprint driven by Jolt Cola to be able to do something meaningful, right? To feel good coming out the other side of it, that what you've built in that time is going to be taken care of going forward. I may not be able to get another 48 hours from you for another year, but a year from now when you come back, it'll have kept moving. So HTBox takes all that other stuff off the table and says, oh, we'll deal with the requirements, we'll deal with managing the relationship and so forth. We even operate the software for the NGOs. We get it distilled down so the developer can pick up a work item they understand in an area they're interested in and can actually get it done in 48 hours.
I love it.
It works.